Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. This is Stephanie McPheeters, interim editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to informing Mainers through investigative and explanatory journalism and empowering them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, the Monitor's reporters and editors talk about the stories we are working on, many of which you have likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. Today, I'm joined by Josh Keefe, our government accountability reporter at the Maine Monitor, and Callie Ferguson, the deputy investigative editor of Maine Focus, the investigative team at the Bangor Daily News. Josh and Callie worked together on a series of stories about a violent arrest by the Maine State Police that occurred in Limerick last year, and about the agency's broader record of clearing officers who have received use of force complaints. The collaboration is part of a new partnership between our two newsrooms and one we're excited to take you behind the scenes of today. Josh, Callie, thank you guys for being here today.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So, Josh, I think we should just start off at the beginning. This project has been in the works for a while. How did you first hear about this incident, and what sort of prompted you to want to really dig into it?
Yeah, I got, you know, how these things often start is I got an email. And the email basically said that there had been this very violent arrest, and that the press release about it that the Maine State Police had put out was not accurate. And this person was alleging that there was actually extreme police brutality during the arrest, and that it needs to be dug into. So I was obviously intrigued, but, you know, we get a lot of stuff that we check out and turns out not to really be what people said it was, or there, even if, you know, there's just no evidence to substantiate it. So I emailed back and was like, you know, I'm interested, but like, what sort of evidence do we have? Is there any, you know, footage? Is there any camera? Were the cameras there, and did they capture what you're alleging? And I was sort of told, well, not yet, but we're hoping to get it. There might be some, kind of, we'll let you know. And, you know, I sort of was like, all right, well, you know, I'm all ears whenever you have it. I think a couple of months went by, and I heard from this person again, and they provided a bunch of videos, and they directed me to a certain part of the video, which showed a Maine State Police officer sitting on the chest of a handcuffed man, hands handcuffed behind his back, and you could see the Maine State Police officer just punching him in the face repeatedly, while he's fully restrained on the ground. So at that point, I was obviously like, all right, well, there's something here. And that started a long, you know, I mean, this was probably close to a year ago. So from there, we, you know, I wanted to see as much video as possible. I wanted to understand the criminal case and the criminal charges that had been filed against this suspect named Justin Savage. And, you know, there were his criminal proceedings were ongoing at that point. So, you know, there was a lot of stuff. We were sort of waiting to see what would happen. Eventually, his charges were dismissed. And at that point was when it really became clear, you know, in my mind at the time was, okay, the prosecutors are seeing what I'm seeing, and they dropped the charges. I don't know that for a fact. They wouldn't comment on it. But, yeah, and it was at that point that we really dug in and tried to figure out what was going on, how the Maine State Police had handled it. We knew at that point that the officer who had been on video punching Justin in the face had been promoted after the fact. So yeah, it's been a long time coming to get this out there. But really what prompted it was seeing that video and realizing you know, there was just really no way to spin that video other than, you know, a pretty obvious, I think to anybody's eyes, like a pretty obvious instance of excessive force. by the Maine State Police.
Yeah, I think, you know, I remember when you first got this information and you know, like you said, we weren't sure really what was there. And I think it was seeing this footage, and particularly this moment you describe where, you know, this and the footage is pretty dark, but there's this one moment that is pretty clear where, you know, this man, Justin Savage, is on the ground, restrained, and he, you know, has there's been, you know, we didn't know what the context was, but we saw this moment, and it was pretty striking. You just see, as a flashlight goes by, you know, this trooper punching him pretty clearly in the face. For those who haven't, you know, read the stories yet or seen all this footage, which we published, you know, a number of videos, including a sort of full 40-minute video that where you can basically watch the whole arrest. Can you just kind of talk us briefly through what that encounter looked like based on the footage, and also tell us sort of where this footage is coming from?
Yeah, so I guess it's probably important to say right off the bat that at the time, the Maine State Police did not wear body cameras. So this footage is all coming from cruiser cameras, like dashboard cameras. And then there's a brief period where Savage is in the police car where there's a sort of interior facing camera that captures a lot of it too. But so that's where the footage comes from. What happened that night is the police are called out to Limerick. There had been 911 calls from Savage's neighbors. There it's you know it's sort of conflicting reports on what happened, but basically Savage and his girlfriend had dropped off a neighbor from that house after a night out. They drop him off. The other neighbors in the house, there was some sort of argument. It gets heated. The neighbor who called 911 said that during that argument, Savage had hit his girlfriend, and then that she had tried to intervene, the neighbor that is, and Savage had pushed her. And then he, when she went back inside the house, he sort of ran up and knocked on the windows. Savage's girlfriend say that didn't happen. So and ultimately it should be said that Savage, you know, charges related to all that were dropped against Savage. But so the police get this call. They go to Savage's house. He's returned home at that point. He comes out to meet the first officer. She's asking questions. He's compliant. He is following her directions. Two other officers arrive. They pretty quickly put him in handcuffs. At that point, he starts to talk back to them, starts to insult them. He doesn't seem to be really physically resisting, but he's, you know, he's kind of being obnoxious to them. But during that, they tell him, eventually they tell him, okay, you're under arrest for disorderly conduct. Keep in mind, he's on his own property. And has only been talking at this point. It's the only thing they're really accusing him of. Anyway, when they do that, as soon as they say you're under arrest for disorderly conduct, the sergeant at the scene body slams him to the ground. In
And
doing
he's
that,
already handcuffed at this point,
he's
right?
already handcuffed. Yeah, body slams him to the ground. The sergeant who body slams him, his ankle is broken during that body slam. The two other officers, the sergeant is sort of on the ground with a broken ankle. Two other officers bring Savage to to one of their police vehicles. They put him in the back, or sorry, they put him in the passenger side. As they're restraining him, or they're trying to buckle him into the car. Again, he's handcuffed. They write in their reports that they punch him in the face and elbow him in the face to gain compliance to buckle him in. Can't really see that on the video. It's dark. It shows inside the cruiser, but what you can see is them sort of yelling at him to stop resisting, and him repeatedly saying, "I'm not resisting. I'm in handcuffs. Like, stop hitting me in the face." I think he basically says at one point, and they accuse him of spitting at them. He insists over and over again he's not spitting, but he's bleeding from being he would later say, from being punched in the face, and sort of later explained as he's breathing blood up. Anyway, they put a spit mask on him, basically a hood over him. They put leg restraints on him, and then they leave him in the car. You can see from the footage from inside the vehicle, he starts yelling, "He can't breathe." And he manages to unbuckle himself. He's still handcuffed, and starts pulling on the latch of the door to try to get out. On the other side, the police open the door. He falls out. They jump on top of him. There's a scuffle, but you know, within seconds, he's sort of restrained on the ground. They allege in their police reports that during those few seconds, he bit the hand of one of the officers and kicked him. It's, you know, we don't see that on video, but it's dark. It's hard to tell. But then at that point, he's on the ground. He's restrained. His girlfriend looks like she tries to kind of remove his spit mask to help him breathe. They tackle her and handcuff her. And sort of while they're both on the ground in that moment, it's again, it's dark, except for a flashlight passes over Savage, who's on the ground, handcuffed behind his back. And in that moment, you can see the trooper, Jamie Fenderson, sitting on his chest and repeatedly punching him in the face. So that's what happens, basically. And as that happens, you know, other help sort of arrives, medical personnel. They take him to jail. He's charged with a series of crimes. He's charged with assaulting an officer. He's charged with domestic violence assaults, assault for pushing the neighbor, presumably, resisting arrest. And basically, after that, more than a year later, those charges are dropped. That's sort of kind of a long explanation, but that's what happened that night. The police put out a press release right after that, basically saying that he became combative and he broke the sergeant's ankle, and then he bit one of the officers trying to escape. Which, that narrative just really doesn't line up with what we see on the video.
I think it's worth pointing out that when Josh and I decided to team up to write about this incident and, you know, some broader issues about use of force in the state police, by that point, maybe this was the late spring, I had only seen the video toward the end of this arrest where you can see Trooper Fenderson, now Corporal Fenderson, punch Justin Savage in the face. And I hadn't seen, you know, video of the entire arrest. And we sort of met up to watch the video that we had. And I believe at that point we only had the cruiser camera that showed the sort of scrum on the ground that Josh described, where you see the punches that we've referred, and the cruiser interior camera inside Detective Ritland's cruiser that showed, Ritland and Fenderson sort of trying to buckle him in. But for a lot of the reporting, we didn't know that there was also cruiser video of the very beginning of the arrest, where the troopers arrive and initially interact with Savage and Morse. And for that, we only had news and the police reports to rely on. And which, you know, I think it's important to say, like, regardless, you know, those punches at the very end, I think we were interested in the broader context of the arrest, but I think, you know, it would have been newsworthy and worth investigating even, you know, if we only had that video, because they seemed, because troopers and the police were only allowed to use force to overcome the resistance they're meeting or to keep themselves or others safe. And, you know, I mean, that seemed like definitely questionable demonstration of that. But you know, when we were trying to understand the context, we just had the police reports, which described Justin as being incredibly uncooperative and combative and very aggressive at the beginning of this interaction. And the sort of picture that I had in my head reading those reports to fill in sort of the broader picture of what happened to complement the video was, okay, maybe was one in which Justin seemed like he was perhaps kind of like started this whole thing, you know, was sort of aggressive to start with them. And then maybe this was actually a story about, you know, an aggressive suspect who, you know, the police then sort of met with aggression that perhaps ended up crossing a line. But when we eventually interviewed Justin about this, and his lawyer, we mentioned that, you know, we only had, you know, we were sort of relying on the police's word about the beginning of that interaction in their reports. And, you know, would he want to sort of respond to that? At which point he said, oh no, there's video of that as well. And the reports again sort of described him as like squaring up, like getting in a fighting stance when troopers Fenderson and Schmidt especially arrived. And it was really something to then watch the video, which showed him to be fairly calm and compliant. And you know, that's when we started to really wonder to what degree part of our reporting should not just focus on the conduct that transpired that night, but how the state police and the police officers sort of characterized this arrest in their reports, and then, as Josh mentioned about the press release, publicly as well, because there were obvious discrepancies when we watched the video, which of course is about as objective as you can get, is, you know, a recording.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point, Callie. I think, you know, we learned a lot once we had that additional footage of the beginning of the arrest. And I know you both spoke to policing experts about the footage, and you actually were able to show them some of it. And that also, you know, helped us understand whether what we were seeing, you know, what people who have been doing this work and studying this work thought of it. Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, who you spoke to and what their reactions were when they saw this footage?
Sure. So we showed it to four former police officers who now are in some capacity are either professors or they teach criminal justice or they're expert witnesses. So they testify in court about policing matters. And we constant I think for all four of them, we showed them the head strikes at the end that, you know, sort of the focus, and, you know, the most egregious use of force, and the video that we had the longest, you know, we didn't get sort of the initial interaction till later on the reporting, but we also showed the complete arrest to at least one of the experts. Josh, am I right? I think we just showed one of the experts watched the entire interaction.
Yeah, I
And
think we tried to get more, but it's like a half hour.
yeah, it's yes, right. It's a lot of it's a lot of time to devote. And I mean, all of them were concerned about what they saw. All of them described striking a restrained person in the head as a serious use of force that's difficult to justify. Head strikes are typically discouraged. One of the experts and former police said that, you know, it's not always, I can't remember exactly, it's not the best way. It's not often like the best way to sort of disable somebody, that it can be very serious. When somebody is restrained, when their hands are cuffed behind their back, the reason that police do that is it's very easy to control somebody. You know, when your arms are behind your back, you can sort of lift on somebody's wrists, and it sort of tenses them into a position where it's easy to move them around. So, you know, it's not only that do they have a difficult, it's is it harder for them to be aggressive, but they're easy to kind of control their movements from that position. And of course, Justin was also in leg restraints for a lot of this as well. So all of them said that, you know, there are really rare circumstances in which somebody who is restrained, as Justin was, could pose the kind of threat to justify a use of force, like a head strike. You know, they also the you know the officer who watched And the entire interaction also commented on the takedown in which Sergeant Schmidt broke his ankle. He said, not only did the video sort of not align with the way that troopers describe Justin in their reports as aggressive and whatnot, but you know, he barely had a chance to react when he was sort of the takedown happens after Trooper Ritland places him under arrest for disorderly conduct. It's like almost instantaneous that Schmidt sort of pulls him down onto the ground, and you know, the officer sort of said there was very little justification for doing that. He also questioned the disorderly conduct charge. I'm not sure how much we get into this in the story, but typically that charge is for someone being disorderly in a public place, and this was, of course, in his driveway. So that entire sort of interaction, he had a lot of questions about, and at some point, at one point, said they sort of screwed this entire interaction up from beginning to end.
Yeah, I mean the thing too is, you know, in their reports, two of the officers wrote that as soon as, you know, that Trooper Ritland, who's the one who said you're under arrest for disorderly conduct, two of the officers in their reports wrote that after she said that, that Savage either pulled or pushed or tried to get away, and
He
then
kind of
they took him down.
lunged.
But the video doesn't show that at all. It's instantaneous. He is standing there. He does not move in any way between when she says you're under arrest and he's slammed to the ground. And even Ritland in her report says that it's instantaneous.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it looks kind of like Schmidt is standing to one side of him, and he kind of pulls him and twists around. He kind of ends up, he's the officer kind of begins on one side of him and ends up on the other side. And in doing so, it's a little difficult to see just because while it's a pretty clear view, you know, it's they're at a little bit of a distance. And it looks like his leg, his ankle, which breaks, sort of gets twisted up in this motion. And he kind of, you can see him sort of extend it out a little bit afterward. And again, it at that point, there's a little audio because all of the officers are wearing body mics where you can hear him say that he came down on his ankle wrong. But again, the way that the state police characterize this in the press release the next day is heavily insinuates and suggests that Justin broke this trooper's ankle kind of as a result of becoming combative and attempting to mistake and escape. And sure, his ankle breaks in this motion, but I mean, to suggest that it was Justin who sort of assaulted him, or you know, what you picture when you read the release is certainly not what you see on the video, is a good way of putting it.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning too that Savage was charged with assault on an officer for breaking Schmidt's ankle, essentially. But in the audio, after they've I think after they put him in the car the first time, Ritland asks Schmidt, "Okay, so we should charge him with assault on an officer," and he says, No, like we just, I think his quote is, we just all landed on my ankle the wrong way or something to that effect. So he's very clearly saying that Savage did not assault him and cause his broken ankle, and yet he was charged for that anyway. I think that's sort of important to mention.
Yeah, I think that
But yeah,
was I think that was a really,
sorry.
oh, I was just going to say, I think that was a key part of your reporting, and I think we only found that out because you listened to a lot of this, you know, this body worn audio and watched all this footage. We had, you know, we had a lot of audio and a lot of video footage of this incident, which, you know, you don't normally have. I mean, I think a lot of the reporting that has been done in the past few years, you know, on police brutality, often it's, you know, it's coming out of publicly taken sort of cell phone videos, and there's like a little bit of footage. You don't always have, you know, a whole
picture, and we were able to get this footage because it came out through the discovery process during his criminal during the criminal proceeding. So I think that's also sort of an important note to mention. You are listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. Today I'm joined by the Main Monitor's Government Accountability Reporter, Josh Keefe, and Main Focus Deputy Investigative Editor, Callie Ferguson, to talk about their recent reporting on the state police. So let's talk a little bit. We've been talking a lot about the footage. Let's stay on that for a little bit because, this is a story about how about this particular use of force by Trooper Fenderson, but it's also about how the agency portrayed the events in its internal police reports and in its public press release, like you said. Can you just, Josh, can you walk us through a little bit more about, how those two diverged and sort of what your reporting process looked like there?
Yeah, so I guess it's I don't know if we've clearly stated this. The Maine State Police did look at all of this and found that the use of force was justified. They've stood by that essentially nobody did anything wrong on there. None of the officers did anything wrong. But yeah, in terms of how the divergence between their narratives, both through the press release and the police reports, diverge from the video. There's a few things. One is what Callie referenced, which is the reports. I think it was one of the officers said that when they arrived, Savage approached them in a fighting stance. That was their language. That just is not. That's not true. We watched it. One of the officers said, as the two other officers approach, the first officer's there, say, hey, Justin, can you go talk to them? He says, yep. And he walks over like a normal person walks toward them. And they said that was in a fighting stance. They said that they said that he continued to hold the fighting stance and look like he wanted to swing at them throughout. None of that's visible. Also, they put him in handcuffs within a minute of arriving. Which he doesn't fight them on, he's not resisting them putting handcuffs on him. So a lot of that seems to be, it's just wildly inaccurate, based on the video. And then, there's sort of more, there's other parts that are a little harder to see. Actually, I'll say first of all, too. Then there's the other moment we talked about, which is they say that after he was told he was under arrest, he made some sort of thrashing motion and tried to get away, and that's why they body slammed him to the ground. That didn't happen. We can see it clearly on video. He's standing still. There was no movement between when he's told he's arrest and he's under arrest and when they take him down. Which is violent, by the way. They slam him to the ground while his hands are behind his back. There's a lot of potential for injury there. Then there's everything that happens once they try to get him into the vehicle and they try to buckle him in. They describe him as thrashing and kicking, and that they say that basically that they had to punch him in. They write that they punched him in the face to gain compliance to buckle him in. It's there's a lot of darkness in that video, but what you can see is he's not really moving. He's kind of yelling. He's bleeding all over his face, which, he's not bleeding after the takedown on the ground. You can see him walking to the car, and then inside the car, his face is bleeding. And he says it's because they punched him in the face repeatedly, and they do write in the report they punched him. And they're saying he's spitting at them over and over again. Again, hard to see, but the audio is very clear, and there's certainly no kind of that classic spitting sound happening. And clearly saying he's not spitting, he's just bleeding. So that's part of it. And then
Also, I'll just jump
finally,
in really quick here for a second,
sorry.
Josh, which is that I think you're right. Like these two moments before they put him in the car, it's like they describe one thing and it's pretty clear that the video just doesn't support it. But this part in the car, like, I think what you're sort of saying is it's maybe a little less like cut and dry as like they say A
Yeah,
happened
it
and the video shows B happened. And it's more like they really depict him as incredibly as uncooperative, as spitting at them and paint a very sort of definitive narrative of how he's behaving and attributing, motives to like certain things that are going on. Whereas when you watch the video, there feels like there's just as plausibly a version of events or like that the scenario could be read as a suspect who has been like suddenly, taken to the ground and who's injured, from having been, as they write, punched in the face and who's experiencing a lot of anxiety and struggling to breathe and sort of freaking out. And as far as the spitting goes, he's bleeding through his nose and he sort of says, and it's that, he when you're talking and there's blood pouring over your lips, you might spray somebody. So, we asked an expert about this too, which is, I think this sort of moment inside the cruiser is a little less like they said A happened and video clearly shows B, and more like video presents like a real plausible alternate version of what was going on here, which was, whereas the police make it very clear like this was an uncooperative, aggressive subject that we were like struggling to control, that this could just as easily and maybe even more plausibly when you watch the video, like a very distressed person reacting to, a very forceful apprehension. And I'll let Josh kind of continue from there because there's some other detail that sort of maybe supports that version, which is that Justin said he was struggling to breathe. But when we read the report and then showed this part of the video to an expert, for instance, like this expert, this policing expert said, like the video more that he would be more likely to believe Justin's version of events that he was struggling than the police's based on what's on the video. But it's a little more, I guess, less cut and dry is all I wanted to say.
Yeah, it's also, yeah, there's parts of it where it's kind of complete black and then there's light. It's sort of hard to, it's not all sort of perfect
Which is
gray.
why I think in our reporting we describe as like moments in these police reports where like video contradicts what they write. And then, but there's, I think we also just sort of describe some of the character reasons is it's generally misleading that it really, if you were to just rely on the press release, on the police reports, you would get, I think, at the very least, an unfair sense of what this interaction was like and that the video not just contradicts moments, but just paints a really different picture than the police reports. And I think that the whole description and footage of inside the cruiser is a pretty good example of what we mean by that.
Yeah, and then really, I mean, really just, the final thing is, after he's on the ground, after his girlfriend has been taken to the ground, they really don't mention the fact that they punch him in the face multiple times. And on the audio, you can hear, Savage's girlfriend begged them to stop punching him in the face.
She also says that he has asthma, right? Which
Yeah,
is
she's screaming that he has
part of an
asthma.
issue when
And he
he's
says
saying he can't breathe.
he can't move. Stop punching him in the face. His face is broken. Stop. And eventually she tries to tell Detective Trooper Ritland, who's the one who sort of has her handcuffed, has the girlfriend handcuffed, and she says, "Please tell him, basically tell him to stop punching him." Trying to get Ritland to intervene, and Ritland very clearly on audio tells her, "Just look away, turn your head." And it's a pretty striking moment for me because officers have a duty to intervene when they see. when they see their colleagues doing, using excessive force. That did not happen here, very clearly. So yeah, I mean, I guess, all this that happens and these police reports that really don't match the video and everything else, that's one layer of, I don't want to put a judgment on it, but it's one layer of, I would say, concerning behavior, by the Maine State police on the ground. But, there are accountability systems in police departments. Nobody expects police to be perfect all the time. That's why we have systems for, discipline. And what happened here was that the Maine State Police decided, looked at all this, and decided it was fine, which is a whole different issue than the initial conduct, because now you've sort of endorsed it from the highest levels of the Maine State Police. And we know that Colonel William Ross, who is the head of the Maine State Police, we were told by his second in command that he had seen the footage and he was comfortable with what was happening there.
Yeah.
So,
So
yeah.
let's talk about the police, the state police's response now, because we've spent a long time talking about that night and sort of what your reporting showed. So we know that this Justin Savage's girlfriend, who you mentioned, Shauna Morse, after this incident, she filed the formal excessive force complaint. Callie, can you just tell us sort of what do we know about what that process normally looks like, and what was the agency's response in this case?
Sure. So, the state, regardless of a complaint, the state police officers are required to fill out use of force reports and report that they use physical force for any time that they do so, and beyond just handcuffing somebody. So, the state police, and of course, police, they're allowed to use force in the course of their duties with aggressive or uncooperative subjects, to defend themselves or others. They've used force beyond handcuffing hundreds of times in the last decade, according to some statistics we've received from the agency. In this case, and then that gets reviewed by their supervisors, and usually like the amount of review is commensurate to the level of force and the seriousness of the incident, as I understand from having spoken to the agents, people at the agency. In this case, Shauna Morse, Justin's girlfriend, who was, of course, involved in this and a witness to it, also submitted in May, so about a month and a half after the arrest, a formal complaint to the agency in which she alleged, that her boyfriend had suffered a brutal assault and it should be reviewed, and that it caused, but she herself described having nightmares from the whole thing, and it's like a 1.5 page description in which she outlined, described what happened. The state police has a policy when they receive complaints that their internal affairs division, which is called the Office of Professional Standards, is required to conduct the investigations into complaints that allege serious misconduct, which could include potential criminal conduct. But they also have the ability to delegate complaints for lesser charges. And in this case, we understand from our reporting, Shauna's initial complaint was not initially investigated by the Office of Professional Standards. The troop supervisor handled it. So, in other words, I mean, it would stand to reason that they did not consider her complaint to be alleging serious misconduct, which, I mean, I could bring up the complaint, but it alleges, essentially a criminal assault. So, we didn't get a good explanation for exactly what their thinking was and why they made that decision, but that was a decision that they made.
So I'll just say real quick, we talked to other experts who said basically anytime there is serious injury to a suspect and somebody alleges that it's because of,
Yeah,
basically
that his
brutality,
injuries
that's
alone,
serious,
in
that should be
which,
considered serious
yeah,
misconduct.
he had a
But
broken nose.
it's
I mean,
really not.
He was facing, the first time I met Justin was in court when he reached a deal with prosecutors to drop all these charges in April. And I did not recognize him when he came into the courtroom because I, up until that point, I'd only seen his mugshot. And the side of his face was so swollen from bruising that he looked like a different person. So, I mean, that alone, yeah, what I think it was a former Department of Justice lawyer that we interviewed about this was like, that injury alone is like, it doesn't necessarily prove anything yet, but it's basis for a more serious review. Shauna got on the phone with the head of internal affairs after they had finished their investig after this investigation had been completed. It was, I think, in like late June, in which and he you know he mentioned to her that it had been reviewed by the troop supervisor and. And she pushed back against him, and as we understand, I think continued to contact the agency. And it was only when the agency, when she sort of was saber rattling, I guess, about potentially suing them, and they got the sense that they might get sued, that they decided to ask internal affairs to take another look at this. And the internal affairs, the second investigation, upheld the original finding that the force was proper and justified. But it was only after the sort of fear of litigation that the internal affairs unit looked, and we only learned that this summer when we started reaching out to the state police for with questions about this. And initially they told us that IA had looked at it, and when we followed up saying, with the questions, they broke it down for us that there had been these sort of sequence of reviews.
Yeah, let's talk about, what you all were able to get from the state police. I know, there was a whole back and forth with them this summer, and initially they were pretty reluctant to answer questions, it seemed like, and eventually we were able to get a little more out of them. And Josh, you were able to speak to Lieutenant Colonel Brian Scott, who is the agency's second highest ranking official. Can you guys just tell me a little bit about that process?
Oh, I was just gonna say they had gotten, by the time we had really started asking them, we sent them a long list of very detailed, specific
Before that,
questions.
we asked for an interview. I think it's worth saying that we've been describing this video, and we showed it to experts before we reached out to them, just to be confident in our the conclusions that we were drawing. I think that we published the video. To some degree, it feels like it speaks for itself. But of course, as reporters, like, we want to make sure that we're, asking all the right questions. So we initially asked for an interview with them, and because they had received something called a notice of claim, which is sort of they had been put on notice that they might be sued, they declined to sit for an interview because, of potential litigation over this. And a spokesperson for the agency also referred us back to their original press release, which of course we were quite familiar with because it was sort of part of our reporting. And at that point, we sent them a very detailed, long list of questions. Josh, I'll let you continue where you left off.
Yeah, at some point, so they said that they basically couldn't comment on what happened that night because of they'd received the new notice of claim, which is basically just letting them know we plan to sue you. But we had a lot of questions that weren't really related to what the lawsuit was about, which is which eventually was filed earlier this month. Which, Justin's alleging, assault and, the violation of constitutional rights and sort of a myriad of other things. But our questions were really about, we were kind of like, okay, we understand you're not going to talk about what happened that night. We have questions about how you handle these kind of complaints. And we didn't really get. We got some clarification, but at some point, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Scott, who's the second highest ranking member of the Maine State Police, called me. And he sort of had the same line. I can't really talk about what happened that night, but what he said to me essentially was, We've looked at it. We're fine with what happened. We've seen the video. We believe it's justified. Both he and his boss, the head of the Maine State Police, have looked at it and we're fine. He's with it, he said. And he said that he had other information, essentially, that wasn't on the video, and that is what sort of led them to believe it was justified. He wouldn't clarify what that was. That being said, we have the police reports. We have everything the police said, wrote what happened. So it's totally unclear why the police would have information that they wouldn't put in a police report. It's hard to know. But basically, he said, yeah, if I told you, maybe you'd understand it better, but or maybe you'd say you still have a problem with it. But yeah, essentially that there was secret information that was neither in the video nor in the police reports that he was basing some sort of decision on. And so yeah, I mean, at that point, I guess we should say, that was not long after prosecutors dropped all the charges against Savage. And we've asked them, the prosecutor, York County District Attorney, about why that was, about, they wouldn't comment on it, on that decision. But certainly Justin's lawyers, both his criminal defense attorney and his now his lawyer, who's bringing the civil lawsuit against the state police, both believe they dropped charges because they couldn't prove them, and because the video contradicts what the police said happened then.
Right. And the lawsuit you mentioned, they're now hoping to have a jury trial. So I think we'll see what happens with that lawsuit as it continues through the federal court process. You are listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. Today I'm joined by the Maine Monitor's government accountability reporter Josh Keefe and Maine Focus Deputy Investigative Editor Callie Ferguson to talk about their recent reporting on the state police. So we've talked a lot about this one, really violent arrest in Limerick and your reporting there, but your investigation also zoomed out to look at how this fits into a broader pattern, and that was largely thanks to some data that you had gotten, Callie. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So it was around the time that Josh was looking at this video that I was looking at some statistics that I had gotten from the state police showing that they in 10 years between 2015 and 2024 had received 33 excessive force complaints and had never once found any to be sustained. When the state police receives an excessive force complaint, they have four primary options or like outcomes that they can reach when they investigate it, which is to exonerate the officer, which means they look at the facts and found that there was nothing unjust or improper, that the complaint is unfounded, so there's no factual basis for really an excessive force complaint. They can sustain the complaint, so find that there's legitimate there's legitimacy to it, and then they can also reach a finding called not sustained, which is essentially that neither enough like not enough information to say either way. And when we looking at this, a lot of the police that we interviewed for this pointed out that it's very difficult to be perfect in law enforcement. It's a really difficult job. You're often going into messy, stressful situations. Law enforcement is drawn from the human race, and people aren't perfect. And that, it's really difficult to achieve perfection in law enforcement. And here was a record that, was perfect on excessive force. Those same experts, one of them pointed out that that in and of itself, a spotless record doesn't mean that it's
that we should doubt it, even though it's implausible, maybe, as some people described it. But it was really that in the context of a case like Justin Savage's, where you do have what, in the opinion of experts, believe was a case of excessive force, that was among the complaints, and that was not considered excessive. It does lend a lot more credence to suspicion of their record overall. So we looked into that as well. We did some additional reporting about, the sort of how this case fit into that larger pattern. Part of that reporting as well was to kind of look at, whether other large police departments in Maine had similar records, and we found that they didn't. That excessive force, sustained complaints of excessive force in Maine are rare, but they're not unheard of. We asked Portland, Bangor, and Lewiston, which are the next three largest departments, municipal departments, and all of them in the same period have sustained cases of excessive force. Usually, it's like one or two, but it does happen. So, basically, like we have a hard time knowing exactly what was the substance of those other, I guess, 32 complaints in that period of time. Complaints against police, excessive force or otherwise, are not public in Maine. Only findings of discipline are public records, considered public records in Maine. So it's difficult for us to examine each of those complaints in the way that we did with Justin's case, because we don't have all the records there. But
And just to add to that, Kelly, I mean, like you said, there the only way you can kind of see into these complaints is if they result in discipline for an officer, right? So there's sort of an incentive to never sustain them because then they remain secret. I'm not saying that's what they're doing, but if you don't want these complaints to see the light of day, you can simply always find that they're unfounded or they're exonerated, which is what the Maine State Police have done.
Well, we've done some at the BDN, some reporting about discipline at the state police. In fairness to them, they have disciplined officers in the past.
Right, we're just talking, sorry, we're talking specifically about excessive force complaints. Yeah.
Okay. One of the other we could talk more about this data, but one of the other things I really wanted to touch on before we run out of time, which is coming up, is just what has the reaction to the story been? It's been out for a little bit now. What have you heard both from the public, but also from lawmakers and other state officials now that the reporting is out there?
Well, lawmakers, we asked every single member of the Criminal Justice Committee in the legislature, which oversees the Maine State Police. We only heard back from one of them who said that they were aware of it and they were looking at it.
Well,
We
we
asked
heard
the
back from
governor.
two. I spoke to the House Chair of the Criminal Justice Committee, Representative Tavis Hassenfuss, and who's a Democrat from Reedfield, and he said that the committee was aware of it and what he basically wanted to spend more time absorbing the details of the case, to include watching all the video and stuff before making a determination, but that they were paying attention, and that when he understood it better, that would sort of determine what course of action they would take next, to include, do they need to do their own investigation? Do they need to have a hearing? And these were all possibilities. He didn't say any of that was necessarily going to happen, but that they were looking into it. Sort of difficult to know, and to follow up with him in a couple of weeks is what he said. I also heard back from the spokesperson for the Republican House members of the Criminal Justice Committee, which I think is three members, and all of them said that they did not want to comment on something that was being litigated, and that was the facts of the case should be litigated in court. To be clear, Justin's and Shauna's lawsuit does does touch upon the excessive force, as well as there's a claim of defamation, which relates to how the state police portrayed it and whatnot. But a lot of our questions are not just about what do you make of the treatment and, the use of force against Justin, but how, what do you make of how the state police handled it internally, which is not really the subject of the lawsuit. So we haven't necessarily gotten very straightforward questions about responses about that. But I think as far as the lawmakers are concerned, I don't think we've heard the last word from them about that. But Justin or Josh, I'll let you
Well, no, I was
describe how the
going to
governor
say,
reacts. Yeah.
yeah, but also there's nothing that's, I mean, lawmakers are elected officials. They can have their own opinions. They can answer questions individually. There's no tradition or rule that says the Criminal Justice Committee has one spokesperson. We asked every single one of them. None of them responded except for one. So,
That's true. We reached out to all of them, and we, except for
one of
Representative
them could have
Asenfis,
given
yeah,
their opinion
didn't
or
hear
said
back.
something or responded, given that their job is to oversee the Maine State Police. They did not. The governor also, I asked her about it. She said basically there's a lawsuit. She's not going to comment. And I followed up and said, well, the lawsuit is one thing, but how the Maine State Police handled this after is not part of that lawsuit. And I essentially, I mean, I said directly, like, do you trust the Maine State Police to investigate itself? Like they did here, and she said one comment, she cited the lawsuit again. So yeah, we haven't heard much from elected officials. We've heard a lot from readers, and there's actually a YouTuber who did a whole video. He's was basically went, got like 500,000 views in a day or something, and so we've heard from people who've seen that from all over the country. I've heard from people from other countries, writing in about it, but yeah, nothing from lawmakers as of yet.
All right, well, we'll see what folks have to say as they, get time to watch the videos and really absorb your reporting. I know we could talk about this for a lot longer, but we are at time. Thank you both so much for taking us, behind the scenes on this really important accountability work that you all did.
Of course. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thanks for having us, Steph. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU-FM and the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. To read Josh and Callie's stories and learn more about our reporting, visit themainemonitor.org. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Stephanie McFeeters, and this is Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill.